is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, participating in the U of I Brown vs. Board of Education commemoration with the Department of Theater presentation of Lorraine Hansberry's play, A Raisin in the Sun, opening March 11th, and with in-progress showings of work being created by performance artist Ralph Lemon to be premiered at Krannert Center. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com. AM 580 thanks Champaign Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our talk show for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Jason Croft is at the controls. Just very quickly, let me mention tomorrow morning in the first part of the program, we'll be talking with May Barenbaum. She's a professor of entomology at the U of I. She is a scientist who studies insects and occasionally is here on the program, and we talk about that. And this time of the year, for quite a few years, we have had her here to talk about an event that she started and now has become world famous. And, of course, we're talking about the Insect Fear Film Festival, an event where, if you've been, you know what it's about, but where they show some really bad movies about big bugs and then also use that as an opportunity to do some education about insects and how they live their lives. And it's a fun event. It's been going on now here for, gosh, I don't know, maybe about 15, 16 years. And we'll talk about this year's edition tomorrow. Also, we'll talk with John Wilson, who is over at Illinois State University. And we'll be talking about the issue of academic freedom and particularly some of his concerns about what has happened to academic freedom over the last few years in the United States. He'll be here in town to talk as a part of a lecture series, a longtime lecture series on the campus called Know Your University that happens at the University Y. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this part of the program, our guest is Robert Hill. He's an historian at University of California at Los Angeles, and he is here to take part in another long-running lecture series on the University of Illinois campus, and that's the series that they call MillerCon. We have had a lot of these folks on this program to bring them to a little bit wider audience outside of Champaign-Urbana. This is the 7th annual W.E.B. Du Bois lecture. It will take place today at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. And of course, these events are always free and open to the public, and anybody who was interested in attending should feel welcome. He'll be talking about the Harlem Renaissance and its origins, and we'll try and cover some of that same territory here this morning. And questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
First, I think probably we should, or I should ask you to talk about, generally about the Harlem Renaissance, as I'm sure that people are familiar with that, with it, just at least they've heard of it. But I'm not sure that people appreciate just how significant this period was to African-American culture, but also to American culture generally, this great flowering of the arts. African-American writers and artists and musicians, all of them living and working in Harlem in the 1920s. So perhaps we could start there. Talk a little bit about the Harlem Renaissance.
Well, the Harlem Renaissance is a landmark event that developed in the New York area of Harlem around about 1925. And it continued right through the Depression years. And it was a very exciting period. It lays the groundwork, the foundation of 20th century African-American contributions to American culture and art. So all of the great figures, Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, County Cullen, the painters like Aaron Douglas, many musicians, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Cab Calloway, Lena Horne, performers. I mean, it was the great cultural flowering that today, I mean, anyone who thinks about 20th century African-American culture or American culture usually have in mind this is the backdrop. It was called the Harlem Renaissance. It was called that by John Hope Franklin in 1948, and that name stuck, but at the time it was known as the Negro Renaissance. But the Negro Renaissance also coincided with one of the greatest, most potent, creative movements in world culture, the last total complete style. I'm referring to what became known as Art Deco. Mm-hmm. And jazz and the Harlem Renaissance were central to the development of Art Deco. And those two really are very intimately connected, so that the Harlem Renaissance had a global appeal, not just a racial appeal.
Well, let me ask you to then make the connection with that. Mm-hmm. I know this is something that you'll be talking about. There was, and I guess this would have been beginning in the late 1700s and into the early 1800s, mm-hmm. in Europe, an explosion of interest in Egypt. Mm-hmm. I guess a lot of that had to do, mm-hmm. with Napoleon's having gone into Egypt, yes. and stealing, mm-hmm. a bunch of stuff and taking it back, mm-hmm. to Europe. And it was very influential in, mm-hmm. in the fine arts, in, yes. in art, design, architecture, furniture, mm-hmm. clothing. People got very excited, yes. about that. Then there was then again another, I think connected with that, but somewhat new, another resurgence in, mm-hmm. that in the 20s that, mm-hmm. was and touched off in part by the discovery of the tomb of King Tut. So people,
that's
got
true.
Very, very excited again about, mm-hmm. things Egyptian. So what is the connection between that,
mm-hmm.
And then that also influenced the Art Deco period,
mm-hmm.
of again
in a very big way.
In a very big way, again, mm-hmm. in terms of art, design, textiles, furniture, mm-hmm. architecture, all kinds of things. So what is the connection between that and between that interest in Egypt,
mm-hmm.
and the Harlem Renaissance?
Mm-hmm. Well, the phenomenon that you're referring to is known as Egyptian Revival. The Egyptian Revival is something that punctuates all of Western recorded history. The first great revival of interest in Egypt took place in Greece. The historian Herodotus writes copiously about the importance of Greece, the importance of Egypt for Greece. Egypt, there's another Egyptian revival during the Renaissance. And there is then another revival at the end of the 18th century, as you rightly point out, following Napoleon's invasion of Egypt. There's yet another great Egyptian revival that followed the opening of the Suez Canal in the late 1860s. And out of that, a great deal of European music would emerge. Many people know the opera Aida, but that came out of that revival of interest in Egypt following the opening of the Suez Canal. The last great Egyptian revival was the discovery, triggered by the discovery of the tomb of King Tutankhamun, the boy king. It's the discovery of that tomb was the only complete tomb of an Egyptian pharaoh that has ever been found. It is considered by many to have been the world's greatest archaeological discovery, and certainly the greatest archaeological discovery of the 20th century. That set off all over the world what has come to be known as a wave of Egyptomania. Mm-hmm. And my lecture is an attempt to show that that's the real origin of the concept of the Harlem Renaissance, that it was an extraordinary African-American interest, which unfortunately no one has ever written about, in things Egyptian that paved the way, that led the way for this idea of a regeneration of African-American culture. Now, there are competing and complementary notions of Egypt. The African-American concept has, to a large extent, been grounded in a notion of Ethiopianism, meaning that Ethiopia ruled over Egypt, meaning that the source of Egypt's greatness really is traceable back to Ethiopia. So there was certainly a tradition of trying to ground the history and culture of Egypt in a notion to which African Americans feel great affinity, namely our relationship to Ethiopia. But there's another view of Egypt, a non-Ethiopian view of Egypt, which to a large extent comes to us via the black Masons, for example, the Prince Hall Masons. And so you have these two views of Egypt, one an Ethiopianist version and the second a more a fraternal concept of Egypt. And what I try to show is how the Harlem Renaissance was built out of these two complementary ideas of Egypt. But most interestingly is how this wave of Egyptomania set off in November of 1922 with the discovery of the tomb of King Tut could have had such a pervasive impact all over America, but particularly among blacks. And yet, it's a subject that no one has written about. I find this very interesting.
It's interesting to me in that it seems that interest in Egypt by African Americans, we think of that as being a relatively recent phenomenon. That is,
it hasn't been.
Yes. This indeed goes back a long time.
And it's, to a large extent, this has been one of the important intellectual contributions of the black Masons. They have always based themselves on the ritual of Egypt. And the belief, of course, is that Masonry started in Egypt. That is its source. It's also the source. And let me say that people today who think about these subjects claim that there are really three areas that can explain the allure that Egypt has for people generally. One is the Egyptian belief in the immortality of the spirit, and the idea that, you know, the religion of Egypt was always to go on living in the other world. So this preoccupation with immortality is one that, you know, we get from the Egyptians. The second is that the Egyptians are identified with esoteric or hidden knowledge, secret knowledge. And the search for the secrets of Egyptian wisdom is something that people are very attracted to. And the third area that might help to explain the fascination of Egypt is, of course, just plain escapism. One reason, for example, that films about the curse of the mummy or the fact that so many movie houses are called the Egyptian, kind of escapist fantasy. But when you put all three together, it's really very extraordinary. People in museums, curators and directors, know that if you want to have a blockbuster exhibition, there's nothing that will rival popular attendance at a museum as an Egyptian exhibition. The only thing that even comes close, only one thing comes close, and it's French Impressionist art. Mm-hmm. Hands down, Egyptian exhibitions, you know, beat everything. So people are really fascinated by this subject of Egypt.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Robert Hill. He's an historian from the University of California, Los Angeles. He is visiting the campus and will be giving a talk in the MillerCom series on this very subject we're discussing this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the U of I campus at the Levis Center. And anyone interested in attending should feel welcome. Also here on the program, questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. When you look at some of the thinkers that were important in mm-hmm. the Harlem Renaissance, or for that matter, mm-hmm. people who worked in visual arts, were there some very specific kind of ideas that they took from Egypt, or what they were seeing of Egypt, the version mm-hmm. that they were getting, or mm-hmm. from the artifacts that mm-hmm. people got a chance to see? I mean, how did that mm-hmm. really translate into yes. what people were thinking and doing?
Yes, well, when people think about the Harlem Renaissance or associate to the Harlem Renaissance, there's one iconic image that they have in mind. And that is the work of the great African-American painter, Aaron Douglas, who was also a superb book illustrator. Aaron Douglas's book illustrations for Alain Locke's classic landmark anthology, The New Negro, that anthology, published in 1925, is the thing that people date the beginning of the Harlem Renaissance with. Aaron Douglas later in life was interviewed while he was a professor at Fisk University. And Aaron Douglas said that everything that he painted, everything, was completely influenced by the Egyptian style. Douglas said that the only thing that was not influenced by the Egyptian style was the eye. Everything else. And it's clear when you look at Douglas's art, you see this powerful, this strong Egyptian influence. What is curious is that his style, which is iconic of the entire Harlem Renaissance era, has the Egyptian influence has never been related to the inspiration of the Renaissance. Now, I think one reason for that is that Alain Locke, the man who claimed that he was the midwife, as he called himself, of the Renaissance, and with good reason, Alain Locke, the patron saint of the Renaissance, he promoted the idea of what was called at the time, quote unquote, primitive Negro art. He was taken with the popularity of Central African sub-Saharan art in the work of Matisse, Picasso, Braque, Modigliani, etc. The avant-garde in Europe were, as we know, Cubism was largely inspired by the model of quote-unquote primitive Negro art. So that people who write about the Renaissance privilege or are taken with this idea of primitivism, which was congruent with what artists in Europe were doing. And therefore, they don't recognize the classical Egyptian influence that underlay the work of someone like, say, Aaron Douglas. In other words, what you have is a contradiction, and that's what I'm going to be talking about. On the one hand, you have the classic inspiration that went into the making of the Renaissance, but Alain Locke changed the focus from classicism to primitivism, and in so doing, distorted the real inspiration of the Harlem Renaissance and caused all of the scholars who came along subsequently studying the Renaissance to focus on primitivism. But it means that we now have to go back to the origin in order to rewrite the real history of the Renaissance, where I certainly am not rejecting primitivism. I'm just saying primitivism was built on this classical substrate of Egyptology, and the representation, the visual representation of it, is not in Alain Locke, because he changed. It's in Aaron Douglas. And I'm showing how to read the paintings of Aaron Douglas.
Let's take a call from someone who is listening to the conversation here and wants to contribute. Champaign County, excuse me, line number one. Hello?
Good morning. Yes. Since you seem to be focusing on the international dimension, I was already going to ask about the importance of the cultural exchange, let's call it, between, we know of those, so many stories of particularly African-American musicians going to Paris.
Yes.
So I'd like for you to just say what you how important that was in the Renaissance. But then this business about Ethiopianism, I'm wondering how much, you know, actual political developments, such as some, it's kind of an untold story about how, even before the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, when progressives here in the U.S. went to aid the in the Spanish-American War, that a lot of people, particularly African-Americans, went to fight the fascist Italians in the war in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And I believe that is somewhat contemporaneous with the last part of the Harlem Renaissance during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
So those two subjects, and I will just hang up and listen. Appreciate your visit. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Thank you for that interesting comment. Well, let me take the second part of the comment first. Ethiopian sympathy for Ethiopia following Mussolini's attack on Ethiopia in 1935 was tremendous. It was widespread. It was deep. I've written about this. Langston Hughes has a wonderful poem about the struggle for Ethiopia's sovereignty. There had never been anything quite like that. Ethiopia's position in black life, in black memory, is sacred. Many African Americans who had never read any history knew of the prophecies concerning Ethiopia in the sacred texts, and so fascist Italy's attack on Ethiopia signaled a tremendous wave of popular support in the black community to come to the defense of Ethiopia. There was a great deal of fundraising, publications, petitions. And at the center of this, you might say, was a revival of Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association. So that's 1935, 1936. It was a very radicalizing moment, because before Europe had to face down the fascist dictatorships, African Americans had already determined that the world would have to take on, in this case, Mussolini and fascist Italy. Now, this is kind of the culmination of a powerful strain in black thought, which is identified with Ethiopianism. And also, that Ethiopianism is one that would have global impact. There's Ethiopianism, for example, in southern Africa. There's Ethiopianism in West Africa. There's Ethiopianism in the Caribbean and in places like Brazil. All of them are tracing the inspiration back to America. So African Americans are identified as the fountainhead of Ethiopianism. It's as if you have the real Ethiopia, and then you have the refracted Ethiopia that African Americans are identified with. So that in Southern Africa, a lot of independent black churches are rename themselves with the name Ethiopia, and they trace the origin of those churches back to the visit of Henry McNeill Turner to South Africa at the end of the 19th century. So that Ethiopianism is a profoundly important part of African-American consciousness and the consciousness of others about African-Americans. Mm. Now, the first part of that question had to do with the music. The reason why the Harlem Renaissance is so important to Art Deco is precisely because of jazz. Not only, of course, was Egyptology and the Egyptian aesthetic important as an inspiration for Art Deco, and we see that in the skyscrapers of New York City, the Chrysler Building, Rockefeller Center, Radio City Music Hall, the Channing Building. American skyscrapers built after 1926 all carry the Egyptian style. You see it also in some of the work of American home architects, like Frank Lloyd Wright and the Prairie School of Architecture. But the music of the 20s, which is so important to the Harlem Renaissance, had the year that Art Deco started in Europe was the year that Josephine Baker arrived in Paris and created a whole revolution in terms of dance and performance in France. She led the way to what has been called the Black Tumult, or the Art Nair phenomenon. Today, it's very clear that Art Deco, when it came to America after 1925, had the kind of reception that it did because of the jazz age here in America. When Art Deco arrived in America, it was never known as Art Deco. That term only began to be used in 1968, and many people think that it began in the 20s. The term Art Deco is a very recent term. It was known as jazz modern. That was what the style was known as. And then it was known as streamline modern, and then eventually just modern. I don't think that jazz, let me say this, the commentators and the people who write knowingly and very knowledgeably about Art Deco today can't always agree on a definition of the style, but the thing they say that it must have is jazz. And if jazz is in it, then it's Art Deco. So yes, I mean, the reach of Black American music beyond America in this period of the 20s is extraordinary.
We're just a little bit past the midpoint. Maybe I should introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Robert Hill. He's an historian and member of the Department of History at University of California, Los Angeles. He's here visiting to give a talk. This is in the MillerCom series, talking about the Harlem Renaissance and how that was informed by or shaped by interest in Egypt. This interest peaked periodically, but particularly here we're focusing on the point where it peaked in the 20s, beginning with, inspired by the discovery of the tomb of King Tut. As he pointed out, it's the only time, either before or after, that a tomb of a pharaoh was found intact, undisturbed. Nobody had broken in, and all the others had been pillaged. But that was the one that they found. And I guess that archaeologists still have this dream that someday they might find another, but not since 1922 has that happened.
That's right.
I know that you have written a lot about and done a lot of research about Marcus Garvey.
Yes, I have.
And I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about Garvey and his movement and also its significance in the Renaissance.
The Garvey movement was part of something called the New Negro. The New Negro was the term that described this wave of Black consciousness that arose in 1917, the year America entered the First World War. There was a sharp, discernible turn in Black thinking, and a younger, more militant Black arose, identified with several publications. A. Philip Randolph and The Messenger, Marcus Garvey and The Negro World, Cyril Briggs and The Crusader, W.A. Domingo. You had a whole slew of, and many of them, very left-wing or very nationalistic. Now, this New Negro phenomenon is also the framework or the backdrop of what is called the Harlem Renaissance. So that Alain Locke's famous anthology is called The New Negro. New Negro is the big envelope in which every single movement between 1917 and, say, 1927, they are coming out of this. Now, Garvey's movement was, as you know, a very popular movement. It had a great appeal in terms of the mass constituency of Black Americans. In that sense, the Harlem Renaissance was drawing on a lot of that energy and a lot of the ideas about relating African Americans to Africa that Garvey symbolized. This idea of the restoration of Black people to Africa and their African heritage is one that Garvey largely was responsible for in the years after 1917. Well, you can't have a Harlem Renaissance without a concept of Africa. Clearly, the two belong together. So you could say that the Garvey movement paved the way, cleared the space for the Harlem Renaissance to come through. The problem is the Renaissance was a more elitist phenomenon made up mainly of white patrons and their Black writers and artists whom they wanted to promote. But Garvey also was responsible for developing a concept of a Black Renaissance even before the Harlem Renaissance. So teasing out the points of similarity and difference between Garvey and the Renaissance is necessary, but they're certainly in the same in the same flow of history.
I'm also interested in hearing a little bit more about Alain Locke. He was a philosopher. He taught at Howard for decades.
Yes.
He was the first Black Rhodes Scholar.
Yes.
He so here's a figure who is important in providing a kind of intellectual underpinning for what it is we're talking about.
Yes.
And I'm interested in, and I am just obviously just learning about him, interested in hearing more about him and his influence, and also, and again, going back to this idea that we're talking about, what it is that he drew, if indeed he did draw some inspiration or some ideas from Africa or from Egypt. Mm-hmm. I mean, were those things influential or instrumental in shaping mm-hmm. his thinking?
Oh, very, very much. Most people don't know this, but in 1923, within 2 months of the discovery of the tomb, Alain Locke was approached by Arthur Schomburg, the great Black bibliophile, as well as Johnny Bruce, and they requested the president of Howard University to grant leave to Locke, and they sent him to Luxor. Locke went out to Egypt and spent many months out there observing what was happening, and in order to come back and report on just what exactly was coming up out of that tomb. Schomburg and Johnny Bruce and people close to them, as well as many African Americans, felt that the European archaeologists would tamper with the evidence. And they were convinced that Tutankhamun was a Black person, and they wanted to be sure that they had someone present who could testify to this. So they sent Locke out to Egypt, and it's in Locke's field notes in Luxor where he begins to sketch out the concept of a Renaissance. And he publishes a very important essay when he comes back, but it's published in an obscure source, obscure to people today, but it was the alumni magazine of Howard University. It's called the Howard Alumnus. And in that essay entitled Impressions of Luxor, with wonderful photographs that Locke took in Luxor, he says that the only way to explain the really extraordinary treasures that were found and the quality of the craftsmanship that went into the making of those treasures, he said this was the product of the first great Black Renaissance. And he says the time has now come for us to have a second Renaissance. And then he comes back to America. In other words, the concept of the new Renaissance that we have come to know is inspired not here in America, but while Locke is out in Egypt, traveling and observing what's going on at the site of the tomb. It's very clear in this essay, The Impressions of Luxor, that Locke is talking about the regeneration of cultural and national spirit. The national spirit, which he is now advocating when he returns to America in late 1924, is where the whole idea was born.
Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Are you familiar with the book Black Athena and its sequel?
Oh, yes, very much. Very much so.
What is your opinion of the thesis in that stuff?
I don't think that I'm qualified professionally to pass a judgment on it. I think it's a very, of course, it has had a huge, huge impact, whether people endorse it or whether people attack it. It's probably one of the most significant pieces of work published, I'd say, in the last 25 years.
I would agree with that.
Just based on the sheer impact of the work. Now, I think he has some important things to say. Whether he carried it off and proved it is another question. Go ahead.
Well, I personally, it led to a personal renaissance for myself intellectually, and I was just absolutely flabbergasted. But I think that he backed off from the ancient model, which I think is probably more accurate than his modified model, which is probably why the book wasn't more successful.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, on the other hand, I think it's sort of racist in that it assumes that all people from Africa are black, and that therefore it's a color-coded continental accomplishment as opposed to a group of people working together.
And, yes, I see.
That disturbs me, and also it would be more appropriate to call it a Berber Athena.
I see.
The Egyptians, who peopled Europe as Berbers, if you want to get racist, after the Ice Ages, are not necessarily as racist as Northern Europeans who are still trying to catch up with everybody in civilization.
I see.
So, I don't know. That's my personal opinion. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Something that I wanted to ask you about, and this kind of raises the issue, just in the more recent wave of interest by African Americans in Egypt, has been controversial because scholars mm-hmm. and other peoples have said, well, the kind of connections that some African Americans are drawing between them and ancient Egypt are tenuous at best. Some people say, I'm not taking a stand on this. I'm just saying there's some people that start saying that. And I guess I'm interested in, to the extent that when the Harlem Renaissance was going on, when people were saying some mm-hmm. of those same kinds of things, was that within the scholarly world, were those ideas getting enough attention so that some people felt like attacking them at that time?
Yes. No, I don't think that in the 1920s there was any controversy or any focus on, you know, what African-American authors were saying. Garvey was the person who was largely the figure attacked in the 20s. Du Bois, to a lesser extent, but they weren't being attacked because they were advocating the black identity of Egypt. This new wave of what has come to be called Afrocentrism or theories of Nile Valley civilization is an explicit attempt to write a racial history. I'm troubled by that. I think that if you are going to vindicate African Americans and Africa, you have to do it with history. A racial history is, I think, fraught with problems, and that is another subject for another time. Mm-hmm. But I certainly think that the value of Afrocentrism is that it's once again gone back to this whole question of Egypt and Ethiopia. And what you see is they take an Ethiopianist view of Egypt. They seek the origin of Egypt south in Meroe, another name for the area of the ancient Ethiopian lands. They seek to explain Egypt through Ethiopia.
A little bit earlier, when in the conversation we were talking about, going back again to the Harlem Renaissance, mm-hmm. You talked about it being in some part a phenomenon of black artists and their white patrons.
Yes.
Did at the time the Harlem Renaissance have some meaning for or some impact on the lives of the mass of mm-hmm. African American people? I mean, did it really go mm-hmm. out and have some significance for people who were black people who were living elsewhere in the United States?
No, that's a short answer. Only the music of this period could be said to have had any kind of popular outreach. The writers and the artists certainly drew inspiration from the energy of this period and the fact that black people had been thrown into a situation after the end of World War I where they had to resist just to survive and to resist tremendous waves of white terror that took the form of race riots all over this country. In the summer of 1919, it was called the Red Summer, there were over 50 race riots that summer. That willingness, that determination to stand up to white violence really was very inspiring to these authors. But whether their writing, whether their production was read by or had great widespread dissemination in the black community, I don't think so. I don't think there's any doubt that this was a very elitist phenomenon in terms of its production.
The period that we're talking about eventually came to an end. Although one could argue that it didn't really. But I guess are we thinking of a period that was a defined time?
Well, this is something that people disagree about. Most people who write about it either say that the Renaissance came to an end with the Great Crash, or the early years of the Depression. They generally agree that it ended, and many do believe that it failed. I'm not so sure. I take the view that the Harlem Renaissance didn't really end. It got folded into Art Deco. And so when Art Deco ends in 1941, it just ended very abruptly. I think, yes, you could say that the Harlem Renaissance as a style ended with the end of Art Deco. But that's a very different novel reading from the more traditional reading that the Harlem Renaissance ended.
Are there some ways in which you can still see it now?
The Harlem Renaissance. Oh, yes. Well, the development of African-American literature is clearly deeply inspired by the writers of the Renaissance. Everything we do today in African-American studies is built around the achievements intellectually, politically, culturally of the Renaissance. So you mightn't be able to see it overtly, but it's the great inspiration of everything we do today.
We're sort of coming down to the point. We have maybe a couple of minutes left, and I guess I'm wondering, are there some last sort of ideas that you'd kind of like to leave with folks?
Well, I'm still trying to sort through a lot of these themes myself. I think that what I'd like to see, I've been pushing this, you could say, in the last several exchanges, I'd like to see a broadening of the approach to the Harlem Renaissance in the context of its relationship to Art Deco. In other words, I'm even suggesting that Art Deco might have began here in America, in Harlem, that it's just possible that this is really where it started. But you can't get to that, you can't really examine that unless you are willing to see these two movements together. Mm-hmm. That's the first point. The second point is that the Harlem Renaissance was a style. And just like Art Deco, it was a total style. Now, the thing we need to recognize is that African Americans, we don't have the wherewithal, the money, the capital, to put up tall buildings and to create an architectural style. The black architectural style is the black body, and that's why dance is so important to this period, because it's the refashioning of the black body in motion in this period that is what attracted Art Deco to Harlem. And I'm suggesting that dance, in other words, could now become a way into an understanding of style and this whole period that connects. I mean, it's no coincidence that the thing that made Josephine Baker what she was and this iconic figure for the Art Deco movement was her dance. Hmm. She revolutionized what the Europeans had known about performance. So I'm suggesting that dance could be a very important new way of studying the Harlem Renaissance.
Well, I thank you very much for giving us some of your time.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. And, of course, people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Robert Hill, he'll be talking about this very subject, the origins of the Harlem Renaissance in the Egyptian revival of the 20s. As part of the MillerCom series, his talk is today at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. This is the 7th annual W.E.B. Du Bois lecture, and all of these talks are open to the public and free to anybody who might want to attend. Again,
Thank you very much.
The broadcast today is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including unique baby gifts with custom baby bedding and accessories, Enzo's Pizza, Brownfield Sports, Stickland Insurance, and Field of Greens. The program's also made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, host Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with one of the editors of Cook's Illustrated Magazine. Matthew Card will join us this afternoon. He's an associate editor in the Cook's Kitchen and currently develops recipes and writes for the cookbooks in the Best Recipe series, as well as for the magazine. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. Taking a look now at what's happening on the Board of Trade and the Mercantile.